to the next. The car had run for 15 or 16 hours. The tank of gas was full when it started. It was down about a quarter of a tank. So if you ever want to run an experiment to see how long your car will idle with it, it was absolutely amazing to me. And I realized the power of distractions. When our kids were younger, Katie took harp lessons up in Oshkosh. Her harp teacher was up near, actually, where Nate lives, not far from Menominee Park. We dropped her off. Our other kids were younger. We went over to Menominee Park. This was in spring, May, perhaps, somewhere in that area. Went over to Menominee Park to let our younger kids play on the playground equipment there. We parked in the parking lot. Kara and David, the doors flew open. They ran out toward the parking, toward the park there to play on the equipment. And they weren't out there but 50 yards. And they turned and they came flying back to the car. The reason? Well, if some of you are familiar with what happens along the lakeshore in Oshkosh once a year, the lake flies hit. And they were thick. They were just thick. Distractions. They couldn't begin to think about playing. They were just all over. Well, distractions come at us in a number of different ways in life. And this morning, I want to invite you to open a Bible with me, the book of Nehemiah. You know, Nehemiah was doing what God had called him to do, to build the walls of Jerusalem. And there were all kinds of threats against him. And today we see just an example of distractions, how they continue. And distractions continue for us also. When you stop and think about the importance of life, what is more important than knowing the Lord God who made us? Nothing compares with that. And then for living life, what is more important than doing what God has called us to do in this world? Fulfilling his purpose for why he created. What's more important than that? But distractions. They plague every one of us. They turn us aside from that which is vitally important. And this morning we see Nehemiah dealing with some distractions as he sought to fulfill God's call for his life. And this morning we want to look at a couple of different types of distractions found in this passage, the first 9 verses of Nehemiah chapter 6. You remember Nehemiah lived for a while, a good part of his life, in the city of Susa, the capital city of the Persian Empire, which would today be in southwestern Iran. While he was there serving as a cupbearer to the king, God laid upon his heart the need to go back to Jerusalem to rebuild the city walls of Jerusalem that had been destroyed. And God prepared the heart of King Artaxerxes, the Persian king, to send Nehemiah back to do that. And so Nehemiah went back to Jerusalem and he started rebuilding those walls, the city walls. But there were enemies who were constantly trying to disrupt that. And this morning we see those enemies continue their work. And they begin with an invitation given to harm Nehemiah. And it begins in verse 1 of chapter 6 with these words. When word came to Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem the Arab, and the rest of our enemies that I had rebuilt the wall and not a gap was left in it, though up to that time I had not set the doors and the gates. You can see by chapter 6, the city walls are already built. Now, around the whole city of Jerusalem, you had a number of different doors, openings in the wall in which they would put city gates. These city gates generally were made of wood and covered with metal to be a protective shield. The gates could be kept open or closed. Generally, they were closed at night for protection, and some of them were open during the daytime so that people could go in or out, depending on whether they were in peaceful relations with neighbors or not at that time. Well, Nehemiah had finished the walls. All the walls were up, but the gates had not been put in the doors in the openings yet. So they were nearing completion. And the word on that got out to these guys that are listed there in verse 1, Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem the Arab, and the rest of their enemies. These guys we had been introduced to earlier in the chapter. Let me just remind you who they are. Sanballat was the leader of the peoples of Samaria just north of Judah, right next to Judah, Jerusalem, but just north. Tobiah was the leader of the Ammonite peoples, headquartered over near where today, modern-day Amman, Jordan is, named after the Ammonite peoples of that period. Tobiah was east of Jerusalem, east of Judah. Geshem the Arab, leader of the Arab peoples, south of Judah. Now you can see they had enemies almost all the way around them. In fact, earlier in the book of Nehemiah, we were told that some of the people of Ashdod, which were over west of Judah near the Mediterranean, were also enemies. None of these enemies wanted Nehemiah to complete the task of building the walls of Jerusalem. Now, why didn't they want the walls built? Because these leaders wanted to keep Jerusalem and Judah weak. That way they had authority over them. And they didn't want to see them become strong again. Now, we read here in verse 1 that word came to these guys, Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem, and the rest of the enemies, that the walls were almost done. The walls had been rebuilt. There wasn't a gap left. It was simply that the doors had not been put in the gates there, and they were ready to be closed up. These enemies could see that their window of influence was closing rapidly. If they wanted to keep Jerusalem weak, they couldn't let them complete the walls and get the doors up. Because once a city in that age could wall itself in, it could hold out for months, years, being besieged by enemies. If these enemies ever hoped to have influence over Jerusalem, they had to keep somehow the walls down or the city open. And they become desperate. When they hear that God's people are finishing God's work, they become desperate. It's not uncommon when we see the church at various points in church history becoming very influential that it seems like the forces of darkness start to whip up a frenzy of antagonism or some sort of opposition. You don't want things to go too well for righteousness if you're on the side of wickedness. And in this situation, these enemies started to become panicked that Nehemiah was going to get the city of Jerusalem to a place that they were impregnable, that they were unable to take them any longer. So they came up with a plan. In verse 2, we read, Sanballat and Geshem sent me this message. Come, let us meet together in one of the villages on the plain of Ono. But they were scheming to harm me. These enemies came up with a plan to meet with Nehemiah, and it sounded very innocent. Interestingly enough, it was not a threat. It was simply, hey, you're almost done with the city walls. We've heard that you're getting ready to finish up there. Let's get together and have a powwow. Let's get together and meet. In fact, why don't you come from Jerusalem to Ono? Now, where that was located was much farther west than Jerusalem was. It was about 7 miles southeast of Joppa, or modern-day Yafo, on the Mediterranean. And it was at the border of Judah. It was about the same distance from Sanballat coming from Samaria as it would be from Nehemiah. And it would be anywhere from a day to 2 days journey for Nehemiah to get over to this meeting place. Now, they were inviting him. They didn't make any threats. They simply invited him to maybe a kind of neutral territory to come and meet with them. The question is why? Nehemiah was wise enough to ask what's going on. And as he sniffed the situation, it smelled like treachery to him. They were scheming to harm me. He knew something was going on. At the very least, Nehemiah knew that such a journey would take at least a day or two each way. Why would he want to give up that precious time when he could be helping oversee getting the gates of the city closed up? Pastor Gordon MacDonald shared the story about the king of Siam in ancient days had an enemy. When he had an enemy that he wanted to torment or destroy, he would send that enemy a unique gift. He would send him a white elephant. You heard about white elephant gifts? He would send him a white elephant, a live albino elephant from the king of Siam. Now, white elephants were very rare. They were considered sacred in the culture of that day. So anyone who would receive a white elephant, an albino elephant from the king of Siam, had no choice but to intentionally care for this elephant. But the elephant would take an inordinate amount of the enemy's time, resources, energy, emotions, finances, and over time the enemy would destroy himself because of the extreme burden of caring for this gift. There's an important lesson in that. Our spiritual enemy, Gordon MacDonald said, uses the same strategy for us. He gives us what seems like a gift. But pretty soon that gift distracts us from that which God has called us to do. This gift may be good in and of itself. Let me just read Gordon MacDonald's application because I think it's very good. And there's nothing wrong with any of these things that he says, except when they keep us from doing what God would have us do. He said, let's say you buy season tickets to your favorite sports team. But because you still have a lot of games to go to, you no longer have time to serve in some area of ministry. Or let's say you buy a summer cottage, but now you miss most weekend worship services because between the beginning of May and the end of September. Or let's say you buy a health club membership to get in shape. You used to get up early in the morning to read your Bible and pray, but now you don't have time for that because you're working out before you go to work. Or let's say you buy a spot for one of your kids on a traveling sports team, and now you're too busy to join in a community impact outreach ministry to the poor. Now, in and of themselves, none of these things are a problem. The money isn't a problem. The activities aren't necessarily the problem. The cottage isn't the problem. The problem are the white elephants in our lives. The things that are good things, but they become something that rule us and keep us from doing the most important thing of life. Doing what God has called us to do, whatever that is. And for each of us, that is different. And Nehemiah looked at the situation and he said, might be all right to come and meet with you guys over there. Might be a nice trip heading over toward the Mediterranean. But right now, God has called me to build the walls of this city. And we've got them done. We just need to get the doors and the gates here. And that's a priority. Because that's what God has called me to do. So that's what I'm going to do. And Nehemiah answers, verse 3. So I sent messengers to them with this reply. I am carrying out a great project and I cannot go down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and go down to you? Now, Nehemiah replied with a reason that couldn't be denied. He didn't tip his hand. He didn't say, I'm suspicious that you guys are going to harm me. I think you're ready to ambush me. He didn't let on that he knew what their real motive was. Rather, just very logically, he replied that I am involved in a great project. Now, you might think that sounded rather boastful, but the word great has the idea not only of a large project, but an important project. So what Nehemiah is really saying here is that I have got a huge and important task on my hands right now, and I can't afford to take time away from what God has called me to do to go meet with you guys. He puts the question back in their court by asking this question, why should the work stop while I leave it and go down to you? You see that in verse 3? He asked them, you tell me why this work that God has called me to do should stop. What do you got going that is so important that this work should stop? He puts the question back in their court, and they can't come up with a good reason why Nehemiah should leave this great work. It's an issue of priorities. It reminds me of the story about a fellow who was sitting at the Super Bowl. He was excited to be at the Super Bowl. He was sitting there waiting for the seats to fill up around him, and all of them filled up around him except for one seat next to him. It was empty the whole time. And he got talking with the person on the other side there, a lady there, and he said, I'm so surprised. The seat is empty here. And the lady said, yes, it was my husband's. And my husband just he passed away. And the man said, well, I'm so sorry, your husband passed away, but I'm surprised that one of your relatives or friends didn't use the seat for the Super Bowl. And she said, I can't figure it out either, but they all insisted on going to his funeral. Well, the idea here of priorities is huge. And that's what Nehemiah is saying. Priorities here. Great projects. Let me ask, what great projects are you involved in for God? What has God called you to do? Being the spouse that God wants you to be, that's a huge priority. Being the parent that God calls us to be, that's a huge priority for us as parents. To serve Him in some area, using your spiritual gifts, using the way that He built you to do what He has called you to do, those are huge priorities. And how do you establish what is a priority and what isn't? Over the triple doorways at the Cathedral of Milan in Italy, there are three inscriptions, one over each of those splendid arches. One of them is carved with a beautiful wreath of roses, and underneath it is written, all that which pleases is but for a moment. And then over another one is a sculptured cross, and the words, all that troubles us is but for a moment. But the very central entrance to the main aisle has this inscription over it. That only is important which is eternal. It's wise for us to ask, as I try to set my priorities for life, what has lasting worth and what is mere fluff? What is it that really has lasting worth? And what has lasting worth? We can pretty well sum up two things that will be eternal in this world, will last forever. One is People. People are eternal. Therefore, relationships are crucial. Secondly, what is eternal is the Word of God, which shall never pass away. Heaven and earth will pass away, Jesus said, but my Word will never pass away. The decrees of God, the truth of God communicating. So it makes sense for us to build our lives serving God, reaching out to people, using His Word, bringing people and the Word of God together. And that happens in a variety of ways, but that is a priority. That has eternal consequences. And Nehemiah in this situation goes on to tell us those enemies didn't give up easily. Notice verse 4. He tells us four times they sent me the same message. They couldn't think of anything new. They couldn't give him a reason why he should come and meet with them and leave the gates open. Four times they sent me the same message, and each time I gave them the same answer. They were persistent in their invitation, and Nehemiah was just as persistent in his declining, his rejection of their invitation, because the priorities for him were what God called him to do. And probably, the more persistent they were in this invitation, the more suspicious he got of their motives. I remember many years ago here on my 30th birthday, we were living in Hancock, Wisconsin, and we were going to go out to eat. Carmen wanted to go out to eat for my 30th birthday, and she said, let's go up to Stevens Point. And so we go out of town, Hancock. We're going to turn and go on the Highway 51 at that time, heading north to Stevens Point. I had a sneaking suspicion that maybe she had something more than just our family going to plan to eat. So as we got to the highway there, I said, Carmen, I know you love steak so much. So I tell you what I'd like to do, since I get to choose my birthday, what I'd like us to do is to go down to Portage, to the Porterhouse Steakhouse, and we'll go down there and eat. And she says, no, we've got to go to Stevens Point. And I said, no, I insist. Let's go to Portage. And we're fighting over the steering wheel. And by this time, I look at her, and she just busts out laughing. She says, how'd you know? I said, I didn't know. Know what? Well, it was very obvious. And you see, that's the way it is. When someone is insistent upon you doing something, come and meet with us, Nehemiah. Come on, over here to Ono. Come on, Nehemiah, four times the same message. Come and meet. Doesn't tell him the reason why. Each time, Nehemiah's suspicion is growing. You want me to come, huh? You want me to come? Not a chance. I've got priorities here. Four times, and Nehemiah gave the same answer. What Nehemiah displayed was the importance of practical wisdom. Number one, Nehemiah knew his priorities, doing what God had called him to do, and he would not be sidetracked from that. Secondly, Nehemiah was not taken in by appearances. He had a healthy suspicion of enemy motives. He understood that there are all kinds of things that would take him away from doing what God had called him to do. Number three, Nehemiah knew the importance of tact. He exercised it well. He didn't attack these enemies. He didn't accuse them of trying to harm him. He just gave them the logical reason why he could not come. And lastly, Nehemiah refused to be controlled by others, especially those who had other goals for him than following God's will. And he chose to do what God called him to do. And you know, that same set of wisdom every one of us have available to us. Nehemiah was given an invitation to harm, and he chose what God had called him to do, that issue of priorities. A number of years ago, there was a fascinating interview that took place between a guy named Mr. Charles Schwab. Many of you are familiar with that name in the financial world. He was at that time president of Bethlehem Steel, and he had an interview with a fellow named Ivy Lee, a self-styled management consultant. Lee was an aggressive, self-confident type of man who, by his perseverance, had managed to secure an interview with the well-respected Charles Schwab, who himself was very self-assured, one of the more powerful businessmen in the world at that time. During the conversation, Ivy Lee said to him, if the management of Bethlehem Steel would follow his advice, the company's operations would be improved and their profits would increase. Well, that's a pretty audacious claim to make. And Charles Schwab responded and said, if you can show us a way to get more things done, I will be glad to listen. And if it works, I will pay you whatever you ask within reason. Well, Lee handed Schwab a blank piece of paper, and he said to Charles Schwab, okay, you write down the most important things that you have to do tomorrow. Mr. Schwab did so, and then Lee continued and said, okay, now I want you to number them in the order of importance. So Schwab did so. And then he said, tomorrow morning, Start on number one and stay with it until you have completed it. And then go on to number two and number three and number four. And don't worry if you haven't completed everything by the end of the day. At least you will have completed the most important projects. Now, you do this every day. And after you have been convinced of the value of this system, have your men try it. And try it as long as you like. And then send me a check for whatever you think that advice is worth. The two men shook hands. Ivy Lee left the president's office, Schwab's office. A few weeks later, Charles Schwab sent Ivy Lee a check for $25,000, an astronomical figure in the 1930s. Charles Schwab said this. He said that was the most profitable lesson he had learned in his long business career, setting priorities straight and following them and not being distracted. Now, these enemies weren't quite ready to give up here. They had another tactic. We read about an accusation they sent to alarm Nehemiah in verse 5. Then the fifth time, Sanballat sent his aide to me with the same message, and in his hand was an unsealed letter. Now, after a total of four such invitations to come and meet and four refusals from Nehemiah, these enemies were getting frustrated. Time was growing shorter. Letters during this period were ordinarily written on papyrus or leather sheets rolled up, tied with a string, or sealed with a clay seal impression. And the seal was intended to authenticate that it hadn't been opened, that it had been written by the person, it had been untampered with, and it was going directly to the one to whom it was addressed. You'll notice in this situation, Sanballat sent an unsealed letter this fifth time. There's a reason he sent an unsealed letter, because he wanted what he had in his letter to be open for anybody to read. He wanted to make some statements in here that would spread. The information would produce a scandal. He wanted others to believe the worst about Nehemiah. And we read about it in verses 6 and 7. In this letter was written, "It's reported among the nations, and Geshem says it is true, that you and the Jews are plotting to revolt, and therefore you are building the wall. Moreover, according to these reports, you're about to become their king, and have even appointed prophets to make this proclamation about you in Jerusalem. There's a king in Judah." Now, this report will get back to the king of Persia. "So come, let us meet together." You see what Sanballat had written in this letter? He had said word out here on the street, word among the nations, word among the Gentiles, is that the Jews are getting ready to rebel. Now, he had various reasons why he said this is the case, that you're getting ready to rebel. He linked it, first of all, to the building of the wall. In other words, why else would Jerusalem need a wall except you think you're going to be attacked? Must have a rebellion in the works here. Secondly, this rumor stated that Nehemiah desired to become king of the Jews. A king is much more prestigious than a governor, and wouldn't Nehemiah logically be motivated to build a wall so he could be the king of the city? Furthermore, the word floating around the Gentile world, he's saying, is that Nehemiah has prophets, just like kings in the Old Testament before the exile had prophets. And Nehemiah's prophets were stating, he is the new king of Judah. You see, he is putting in this letter all kinds of rumors that aren't true, but that would catch people's attention and question Nehemiah's motive. Nehemiah could get in trouble with the king of Persia himself if the word about this rebellion, so-called rebellion, would reach Artaxerxes back in Susa. In other words, if the king of Persia hears that Judah is planning to rebel and Nehemiah is fomenting a rebellion, maybe the king of Persia will send his armies down here and destroy Jerusalem for a second time. And of course, Sanballat would say, "Nehemiah, we don't want to see that. We want to take care of this problem now. So we just want you to know, we're looking out for your good, Nehemiah. We don't want your reputation to be tarnished. So come and meet with us, and we'll straighten it out." Do you see what he's doing? He is giving Nehemiah the reason why he needs to come immediately to meet with them. I want to say this about rumors. They are all over the place. In fact, if you are on the computer, if you have email, you'll appreciate the one following message that was floating around. "Let it be known," this message said, "big companies don't do business via chain letters, and there are no computer programs that track how many times an email is forwarded. And Bill Gates is not giving you $1,000, and Disney is not giving you a free vacation. Okay. Secondly, Procter & Gamble is not part of a satanic cult or scheme, and his logo is not satanic. Thirdly, the Gap is not giving away free clothes. You can relax. There's no need just to pass it on, just in case it's true. There is no kidney theft ring in New Orleans. And Neiman Marcus doesn't really sell a $200 cookie recipe. And this goes on and on. Now, if you are on the internet at all, you know that these are common things that are passed around the internet. Rumors. In fact, there was one just recently, I saw just this week coming out, a story about a pastor who supposedly dressed up as a homeless man, and unbeknownst to the congregation he was coming to, was treated shabbily, and then he revealed himself and got up. Not true. Not true. Rumors. And it happens not only on the internet, it happens as we talk. And rumors can do a lot of damage, and Nehemiah understood that they can do a lot of damage. It's interesting, though, to note how Nehemiah handles this. Nehemiah could have been very threatened by this. They think I'm rebelling? They think I want to be king? If the king of Persia hears this, I could lose my life? He could attack Jerusalem and knock down these walls we built. This could have been pretty intimidating stuff, causing Nehemiah to say, okay, Sanballat, I'll meet with you. Instead, look at his response in verse 8. Nehemiah said, I sent him this reply. Nothing like what you are saying is happening. You are just making it up out of your own head. At this point, Nehemiah feels it's time to respond, but he responds very quickly and succinctly. Basically, Sanballat, you are lying. This is a figment of your imagination, of your own choosing, is what the word means. Nehemiah, if he had agreed to meet with Sanballat, would have given in, not only compromised the time to build the gates of the wall, but it would have compromised truth. And Nehemiah understood, I will answer this, but I'm not going to worry about fighting this forever. Truth will win out. I believe it was Winston Churchill who said that a lie will go around the world while truth is still putting on its pants. It's true. Rumors will spread like wildfire, but they will dissipate because there is no factual basis for them. And Nehemiah gives us an illustration of a man who had a firm sense truth will win out. And if my reputation suffers in the short term, so be it. God has called me to do this, and I will do it. God knows my integrity. You know, there's another man who had a similar thing happen. You remember the account of Joseph? Potiphar's wife accused Joseph of attacking her to rape her. And Joseph said, I did nothing of the sort. But he went to prison because Potiphar believed his wife. And faithfully there in prison, he served God, knowing that truth would eventually be told. And through the generations since Joseph, you hear the name Joseph? What do you think of? You think of integrity. You hear the name Potiphar's wife? What do you think of? You think of rumor and false accusations. Joseph didn't lose a lot of sleep about that. He simply did what God called him to do. Sanballat wanted to frighten the Jews. In verse 9, Nehemiah continues on. He says, they were all trying to frighten us, thinking their hands will get too weak for the work and it will not be completed. But I prayed, now strengthen my hands. The purpose of Sanballat's fabrication was to frighten the Jews. In fact, it's interesting, the word there, that it will not be completed, their hands will get too weak for the work. There's a Hebrew word that's used there that means to become slack. Their hands will become slack. In other words, when you're working, your hands are up and their hands will just drop because of discouragement. You'll want to give up. That's the picture here. That's what Sanballat wanted to do to the Jews. But Nehemiah said, nothing doing. My hands are up to work on this wall and these gates and they're staying up. Yes, it may seem like rumor is spreading and everybody's believing what Sanballat is telling them, but God has called me to do this and I will continue to do it. Furthermore, I will depend upon him. And so he prays just a very brief prayer, the fifth prayer here in this book of Nehemiah. Just a quick prayer. Lord, now strengthen my hands. Nehemiah understood that he needed God's strength. And Nehemiah is a great example for us, not only to remember, I don't have the strength to live life as God would have me. I don't have the strength to do what God would want me to do. I need to depend upon him. And furthermore, Nehemiah gives us an example of one who isn't saying, Lord, do this apart from me. He's saying, do it through me, but just give me the strength. He's willing to be used. That is wise. That is a wise approach to prayer. So these repeated invitations we've seen, this wrongful accusation, did not serve to stop or to hinder the work, simply increased Nehemiah's determination, his dependence upon God to complete the task. Like a bulldog, he would hang on to what God had called him to do, and he would stay the course and finish the walls, and those gates, we'll see, would be put in place. Again, Winston Churchill, who was a bulldog, who said, never, 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 never give up, also said these words of wisdom, you will never reach your destination if you stop and throw stones at every dog that barks. Stay the course with what God calls you to do. William Booth, the founder of the Salvation Army, established that work in 58 countries, colonies. He traveled extensively. He was from Great Britain, but he would hold what he called salvation meetings. William Booth was concerned for men's souls, but he was concerned for their bodies also. And you know the Salvation Army is one of the greatest relief organizations in the world, but it's based upon the gospel of Christ, a desire to meet men's physical needs so that they will listen to the message about their spiritual needs in Jesus Christ. Yet because of the way he approached things, he had an incredible number of detractors. The press would often portray William Booth as a charlatan only out to take people's money. The Church of England talked bad about him. One of their evangelists even called him the Antichrist. Even D.L. Moody did not support Booth initially because he felt the Salvation Army might be a threat to the local church. But despite opposition, Booth continued his work well into his 80s. In fact, the end of his very last recorded speech was these words. While little children go hungry, I'll fight. While men go to prison, in and out, as they do now, I'll fight. While there is a drunkard left, while there is a poor lost girl upon the streets, where there remains one dark soul without the light of God, I'll fight. I'll fight to the very end. He's in his 80s when he said that. What gave him that perspective? Earlier in the years of the Salvation Army, William Booth and his associates were bitterly attacked by the press, by religious leaders, government leaders, attacked on all sides. And whenever his son, William Booth's son, Bramwell, showed William Booth the newspaper attack, General Booth would reply, Bramwell, 50 years hence, 50 years from now, it will matter very little indeed how these people treated us. But it will matter a great deal how we dealt with the work of God. So what is God's purpose for me? What is God's purpose for you? The attacks of the enemy come in all forms and fashions. They will come and they will make us want to let our hands go slack and give up. They will come and they'll make us want to take this distraction and go to meet with the enemy. They will come and they will make us feel like people are going to think the wrong thing about me. My reputation's going to be harmed, even though you know it is otherwise. And in the midst of all of that, we have an example of one who said, I'll rely on God for strength and I'll keep at what he has called me to do, faithful to the end. And that's what he calls us to do also.